Coming up next on Tech News Today, Facebook continues to go all in with Facebook Live, and Chewbacca likes it. Toyota is bringing back the iBot in all of its expensive glory. Project Abacus aims to rid us of those pesky passwords. How smart are our homes, really? And a whole lot more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1519, recorded Monday, May 23rd, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more.
And by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT.
This is Tech News Today, the show where we lay down the tech news and talk about it.
We spread it out on the table. We put a little pile of tech news over there.
We do.
A butter knife next to this pile because it's kind of smushy.
Mm-hmm.
You can cut through it.
I am Megan Maroney.
I think I needed to eat more for lunch. I'm Jason Howell. How's it going, Megan?
It's good to have you back. You were
good to be back.
At I.O.
Yes.
Out in the sun, getting sunburned, getting a cold.
I did not get sunburned, which is actually an accomplishment for me. I sunburn pretty much when I step outside, so I don't know how I avoided it. It was practically like Burning Man at Google I.O., so I'm really surprised that I didn't. But it was a lot of fun, but I'm happy to be back.
Did they give you any smart pants?
That I know of. There really was no giveaway this year, right? Mm-hmm. So you never know. I might get an email somewhere out of the blue that says, hey, we've released smart pants. It's not very far from the reality. I mean, Levi's has their smart jacket, so mm-hmm. I'm sure smart pants are actually next.
I want them to be.
I think you won't have to wait very long.
Okay, good.
Introducing into the show once again, as we like to do as often as possible, is Becky Worley. How's it going, Becky?
I am wearing smart pants.
What? Okay, so what makes your pants smart? I don't know.
I'm not actually.
I don't know.
I just wanted to throw you. But okay. There are smart pants because they have these, I think it's called Athos is the company, A-T-H-O-S, that has sensors in your leggings that as you're lifting weights tells you if you're fully engaging your muscles, taking them to depletion, and other smart factoids. Mm. So smart pants exist.
All right. They're not called smarty pants.
No.
They should be.
No.
Somebody's got to do that.
And now, like, are these the ones that, like, you can press if you need help or something, too? Are those them?
No, they're not exoskeleton-type devices, but they're more sensors. So if you think you've got wearables that'll give you metrics like distance and calories and heart rate, these will tell you about sort of muscle exertion, whether – I don't know if it gives you as much detail as, like, if you've gone into – like you're burning lactic acid, you didn't go to full. It tells you about exertion, basically, to try and give you some metrics for lifting.
Dang, the future's weird.
I know. Well, there were some smart yoga pants that you could, like if you were walking home alone and someone was following you, you could press them and then it would, you know, I don't know, notify the police or something. Mm. But I haven't seen those on the market yet.
Smart pants.
Wow. It's amazing that that innovation hasn't just taken over retail stores everywhere. I'm kind of shocked.
We're charging our clothes.
Yeah.
It's a reality, whether we like it or not. It's a reality right around the corner.
Mm-hmm. But we don't really need to have smart pants. When we have Facebook Live streaming, they have released all kinds of new crazy features. First, they will allow for continuous live video for some partners. Now, I read this over and over again. I'm not sure if this is like anybody could do this, if I could do it, or you have to be a partner. You might just have to be a broadcaster, which is anyone these days. So this would be ideal for nature cameras and the like. So you just press the Facebook live streaming button, and you used to be only be able to stream for 90 minutes at a time, but now you can stream for much longer. The only drawback is you can't get it later, because that would be crazy to have unlimited streaming video on Facebook. Nobody has that much storage. It seems a little bit dangerous. If I get this right, like you would just like put your phone on or your laptop and then stream live and then go to work so you could like see your dog or something. What do you think about this, Becky?
I don't think they're going to open it up to the everyday individual. I think this is really San Diego Zoo and the Hawk Cam at the Washington Mutual Building in Seattle. I think that's what they're really talking about, are established sort of, I could see a surf cam maybe, and I'm sure they'll have a program where you can apply for that type of 24/7 broadcasting. I think Mark Zuckerberg's obsession with live video continues to boggle my mind. And I read today, this is anecdotal, it's not from a survey or anything that I can cite, but I'm curious what you guys think. One person saying that people watch live video 3 times longer than they watch regular video. Now, I know with regular videos, 90 seconds is about the sweet spot. So we're really talking about 5, maybe 6, 7, 8 minutes for live video. Do you guys watch it that long?
I don't, but I can get where that comes from, because you just wonder, like, what's going to happen next? Like something horrible or something you never expected. So I could imagine that. I mean, they also announced another thing along with this to get people to continue to watch. You can now skip around to the good parts in Facebook Live videos. So the live videos will let you react in real time. You can put like emoji or comments. So now there'll be like a graph. This is what Facebook told Josh Constein at TechCrunch. You can visualize a timeline of when the most exciting part is, so you can fast forward or rewind, for example, of the recorded the clip of the woman laughing hilariously in the Chewbacca mask. And if you haven't seen that, then you've probably, I don't know, not been on the internet since Friday.
I think you could probably skip to about halfway through, because that's kind of
where you go.
This is a pretty infectious video. By the way, what a really good example to Facebook users of why people who don't have a like business interest might want to use Facebook Live. This thing's like, I don't know how many million at this point. 3.5.
133 million this morning. Oh, it's the most watched Facebook Live video ever.
Which, I mean, Facebook Live video just got rolled out not very long ago, but man, in a couple of days, that kind of a viewership, that's crazy numbers.
I know. I mean, I love this woman and her video.
Everybody loves her. That's exactly the point. Like, she's awesome. I want to be her friend.
Like Dennis's wife? I mean, don't you feel like you know her already? Yeah. Like she's someone in your family? But I have a question. I just want to play devil's advocate here, because what makes this so powerful live? She could have recorded that as any old video. It's not like 133 million people watched this live. They watched it in replay. And that's where you're talking about, Megan, that time shifted watching where you can scroll through. And it's great that they now give you some of those features, because it's sort of laborious to watch that stuff after the fact, not in the Candace Payne Chewbacca video, but
name. She's like a celebrity now.
I know. Becky's a real reporter.
This morning. I mean, come on. Yeah, I think some interesting things have happened with Facebook Live over the last little while. As you said, Megan, they're making it easier for people who are watching it time shifted to control the video. They're giving more options to partners. For users of Facebook, have you guys noticed that the notifications of friends going live has decreased? Because it used to be incessant for the first couple months. It was anybody you followed, as soon as they went live, it was popping up a notification. Have you noticed that?
I don't see many at all.
I hadn't seen many at all either. And I don't know, maybe that I just kind of assumed that, you know, like I don't follow a whole lot of people on Facebook. I've got it pretty limited, which kind of tells me that, you know, the friends and family, which is really what I do on Facebook, are not really using Live. That's kind of what I assumed anyways.
I was at GMA on Wednesday morning, and Coldplay was there. And I thought, man, it was so incredible. You know, it was like 15 feet away from the stage, and there weren't that many people in the studio. And I was thinking, I have this broadcasting device in my hand. And as they were warming up in between sets, I thought, man, I could Facebook Live this. And then I just wasn't quite sure that I really wanted to spam all my people with that. And I also wasn't sure what it was going to be like. Was it going to be, you know, 20 seconds of playing and then, all right, it's good enough. You know, I just didn't know what to expect. And I realized, as a seasoned network broadcaster, I'm nervous using Facebook Live.
Yeah, I like when while I was at Google I/O, I didn't do a whole lot of social network stuff while I was there, primarily because I just wanted to be focused on the reason that I was there and not, you know, spend a lot of time looking at my phone and everything. But there was one thing that I really wanted to live stream out just because I could. I didn't choose Facebook Live because I have it, you know, I use my Facebook for mainly personal stuff, and it wasn't the kind of thing that I thought my friends and family would really care a lot about. So I ended up using Periscope. And in my one experience using Periscope there, I realized why I probably won't do a whole lot of live streaming. That's because you just never know how that's going to come across on the other side. You know, it's one thing to record a video and be like, this is a cool thing. You record it. You can watch it after the fact. You go, okay, that looks great. It sounds great. Fine, I'll post it. And it's there in, you know, in its entirety. But this Periscope experience, because I had apparently limited connectivity and I didn't realize it at the time, people were seeing black video. And so you have this intention to use the platform to do this really cool thing. But because it's live, you end up running into obstacles that way as well. And it wasn't until after the fact or about two-thirds of the way through that it was like everybody was like, I don't get it. What am I looking at? I hear you talking, but it's just live video. What's going on here? I was like, well, that was pointless, you know. So and that makes me not want to do that again, you know, or makes me kind of fall into old routines instead.
There was one example that I thought was really good of using Facebook Live where a woman does a cooking demo every day, and she does it live, and she takes questions while the food is cooking and, you know, reacts to people saying, oh, that's a great idea, or could you do that with turkey, or, you know, and I thought, oh, that's a perfect example. Mm-hmm. And then I realized, isn't that kind of like Twit in the chat room? Mm-hmm. Isn't that what we're doing here?
Yeah.
I mean, that live is better. I mean, that's what we used to do the Screensavers Live. That, you know, it's better. It has more energy. Like, sometimes you mess up. That's exciting to watch. I definitely feel like it's better in terms of, you know, the creators and the consumers.
Right. How it pulls you into the experience. Like, why did this video explode? You know, is it the fact that it was live initially, or is it just the fact that it's hilarious? And I think part of the way that she reacted in the video was because in her mind she knew that what she was doing was live at that very moment, and it's a different mindset as opposed to just hitting record and like, okay, I've got all these things I know I'm going to say versus here we go, all right, check out this hilarious thing, blah blah blah, follow beginning to end, and it ends up being funny because of it.
Well, there's another piece of Facebook news. The company announced 360 Spatial Workstation. That's a free software suite for developing audio for virtual reality. So the woman in the mask all around, and the sound would be awesome. The company also announced its acquisition of Two Big Ears, a company devoted to immersive audio for VR and AR. So I guess this is if you're in the creation of, I think it's more 360 video, but also virtual reality too. If you are a producer, this is probably big news. This is free software.
Yeah, I mean, we've spent so much time thinking about how VR is immersive from a visual perspective because, you know, to be honest, that's the easiest thing to demonstrate, you know, in a video player. You can be like, see how it surrounds you and isn't that cool and all this kind of stuff. But audio, as it is in film and as it is on TV and all that kind of stuff, audio is always kind of considered second in line. But it turns out that this stuff is really important with how our brains perceive these experiences. You can have bad audio and amazing video, and it actually, studies have shown, makes the video look bad to the person who's experiencing it. Mm-hmm. So this is just all about, you know, matching with tools the platform and the capabilities of the VR platform to do really interesting things that go beyond just left and right, that actually go, you know, with audio techniques to be able to space things out so you can tell distance based on what you're hearing.
I'm just hearing a little bit of it now.
I don't know how effective it would be in just, you know, the mix down to stereo when you're not wearing goggles, that all that kind of stuff. But
well, I'm also questioning how this works when what microphone do you have to have? Most of the microphones we have are sort of singularly directional towards the speaker. Mm-hmm. And I looked at some of the audio rigs for 360 setups, and they have 8 to 10 direction arrays of microphones, and so they're recording in 360 degrees with enough throw between each microphone to catch it and then stitch it together. So I am curious if this is sort of doing some sort of digital extrapolating, or is I think that's extrapolating, is when they pull it apart and try and make it sound like it's omnidirectional and that that's really just a trick of the software, or if this mandates a multidirectional array.
I would guess that it's probably largely done inside the software, and that it's that, yeah, the software is helping you create that kind of illusion, I suppose. But I don't know a whole lot about this specific tool, but I understand kind of what the premise is behind it, what they're going for, and I would guess that they probably have support built in for multiple microphones for recording audio sources and something like 360-degree video versus just taking all those different audio points and being able to mix them in a way that matches the perception of the person who's wearing the goggles and everything. And what's also interesting is Facebook bought this company, not Oculus, is a minor difference because Oculus is owned by Facebook, but you would think that this would be part of Oculus. Turns out the reason is because this is a cross-platform tool and Facebook intends to keep it that way. So it's going to continue being cross-platform, not just for Gear VR, not just for Oculus, but for other platforms. And yeah, I think this is great. I love it. So there we go. Speaking of VR, a while back, I guess we're done with that. Sam Moskovich from Ars Technica told us about a cool hack for VR platforms like the HTC Vive. It was called Revive. I think we talked about it like 3 or 4 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. That would allow them to play some of the games released for the Oculus platform. Well, it appears the cat and mouse game is on. Last Friday, Oculus released a software update that was targeted, Oculus says, specifically at reducing piracy on the platform. Oculus said it wasn't targeting Revive specifically, but that it was, you know, caught up in collateral damage. Turns out, though, that same DRM that they rolled out might have opened the platform up even further to piracy. LibreVR, who's the creator of the hack, claims that after the DRM was rolled out, the Revive hack was easier to implement, and the new DRM left holes that were easier for would-be pirators to penetrate. LibreVR doesn't condone piracy, says, urging that users, quote, not use this library for pirated copies of software releases. But yeah, I know. Once there's a limitation, like we were kind of wondering whether Oculus was going to embrace this or not. In fact, Palmer Luckey, who's the Oculus founder, had said in the past that players can mod games to play them on, quote, whatever they want, which kind of seems like that's what was going on here. But they're using the piracy angle as a reason why it's canceled.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that this is just another kind of screw up in the release of Oculus. Like, I think he keeps messing up in a big way on the release, just, you know, with the delays, and then we're going to sell it at Best Buy, even though some early, like, backers haven't gotten it yet. And then this, I mean, I feel like in order for VR gaming to take off, like, they should be more open to different platforms. Like, a lot of average people don't know the difference between an Oculus and a Vive, and, you know, they should just further VR in general and be more open. Like, it doesn't make sense to me why they aren't allowing you to play games on the different headsets.
Yeah.
Reading this story, I realized what a dummy I was about not understanding the business model here. So I'm actually just going to ask this question outright because I think probably lots of people are confused, which is the model here with VR headsets that they are like the console and that they put out their own SDK or their own APIs and therefore only games made with that technology can be played on that VR headset?
I think to a certain degree, Sam would probably be the best person to answer this because he probably knows it right down to the nitty gritty and he's played a lot with all the platforms. But from what I understand, there are similarities between the platforms. There are certain games, certain applications that work amongst them all that are being developed for all platforms, and it's kind of agnostic in that regard. But there are, and Oculus is a prime example of this, there are exclusives that are devoted to that specific system. On top of that, you know, each system kind of has a different control mechanism, right? Like they all have the goggles as a similarity, but some of them don't have a motion controller. Some of them have two motion controllers and all that kind of stuff. So those sorts of things kind of end up limiting and creating almost a built-in exclusivity to a certain degree, depending on what you're talking about. This was a way to open it up, and it still isn't. By the way, it still exists. I'm acting like it's all gone, and it's just, you know, Oculus is fighting it right now. It wasn't opening all games, let's say. I think it was just games that work with the Unreal Engine. So, you know, it wasn't everything. But if it was developed on the Unreal Engine, it was opening that up. And, yeah, that's something versus nothing, I suppose.
Yeah, I just think cracking down on it so quickly and then doing it in a sloppy way that like opened it up even further, that's the mistake. Like, I mean, I understand, you know, the console wars and the VHS and the VCR, it's been going on forever, but it just seemed like it was a little tone deaf to just crack down so quickly and then also in a way that wasn't effective. Like, it was broken in one day.
Yeah. Well, that is true. Mm-hmm. Further evidence of a slowdown in consumer appetite for smartphones is appearing with China's Xiaomi. The company has been riding high by providing some really interesting devices, low-cost devices, high-quality construction in the world's largest market. Xiaomi is the second highest-valued startup in the world, $45 billion, behind only Uber, I believe. But it looks like the smartphone slowdown is hitting the company hard, as it is everyone in this space right now. Last year, Xiaomi saw a meager 5% rise from 2014, accounting to a 3% rise in U.S. terms when you consider the currency rates for the time being. And it's not just the slowdown of the phone market that's hurting it. Xiaomi's internet services revenue was shy of its $1 billion sales target at just $560 million. Xiaomi was really trying to kind of establish itself as kind of like an iPhone-level hardware maker, but also kind of taking the other things that have made Apple successful by, you know, offering a lot of services and that sort of stuff that's really tied into kind of Xiaomi's business approach. And apparently that's not working as well. So you accelerate so quickly, and then, man, all it takes is a year and everybody seems to be crashing down to earth right now.
It also seems to be a little bit reflective of the way Chinese companies report earnings. It's not the same. It's not regulated in the same way that the U.S. is. They don't, they're not as forthcoming. I think this was a report in Fortune, and it was based on something a Xiaomi public official said at a conference. And then when people asked him, when Fortune went back and asked, they said, no, we didn't say that. And it was like on all these websites, and then it was taken down.
And then they removed it, yeah.
Because it was like, they didn't say we've dropped 5%. They said, here's what our earnings were. And then someone said, well, that's dropping. Or, right. It wasn't dropping 5%. It was only going up 5%, which isn't a lot. It is interesting to me because, I mean, even in the U.S., we always want to tell a story around earnings.
Sure.
And there, they're just like, oh, we didn't say that. No.
That doesn't exist anymore. We've removed it from the world.
It doesn't seem that far off the mark, though. I mean, if you think about it, these numbers were even before the iPhone SE would have been introduced or gotten any traction. It's not a competitor story. It's a sort of a this is really about that global slowdown on in phones in general and smartphones, especially when Apple reported, to your point about trying to make a story, Megan, Apple, when they reported their Q1 sales, they said that in China, Taiwan and Hong Kong, sales fell 26% in Q1. And, you know, a couple of years ago, sales were doubling every year, sometimes every quarter in those areas. So this is a big change. And I think it begs the question, are we replacing our phones at a slower rate? Because even in developing countries where smartphones haven't had as much adoption over time as it has in the US, because what are we upgrading for? Mm-hmm. What's motivating that? And I'm sort of using that to segue into the story that rumors came out last week. Applied Materials reported a fourfold leap in orders for equipment to make OLED displays. And a lot of people think that means that the iPhone coming in either 2017 or 2019 will have an OLED screen as an impetus for that upgrade, in that Apple and other phone makers have to do something to get us excited about an upgrade.
Is that a significant enough kind of, spec on the spec sheet to get people to upgrade? I kind of feel like people feel the iPhone display is pretty great, but
yeah,
I know people love their OLED displays.
Right.
So.
I mean, I think battery. The phones are getting, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It'll help the battery. That's the one thing. Although the OLED on my iWatch with the battery that dies at 5 p.m. is not really inspiring a ton of confidence. But
I'm happy to hear you. No one else besides me has a battery that doesn't last the whole day on their Apple Watch. I'm glad to hear that, that someone else has that same
problem. A philosophy that it's, if you have a workout and you put a workout and say, okay, do the workout thing for an hour, that the amount of energy it spends trying to figure out your heart rate is what kills the battery. That's what I think it is. But that's just speculation.
No, that, yes. I've read that. That's true. And also, you probably have the smaller one, too. Like men usually have the bigger one. So it's a large, like, men usually answer my question when I say, my battery doesn't. They say mine doesn't because they have the bigger.
Right, 'cause it's
larger. And the bigger battery, just like we're talking about.
And that'll probably, I mean, that would obviously help the iPhone because the iPhone's bigger than a watch. So there you go.
Yeah. But that is a really, why don't, I mean.
Go ahead.
Why did we feel like we needed to upgrade so quickly for so many years? And then why are we feeling like we don't need to now?
Megan, I was just going to ask that question. See, we were having a little moment where we just like collided in
your
space.
Your brains melded.
Skype. Because there was cool stuff. There was a better camera. There were better speakers. There were bigger screens. Tons of stuff. I feel like every year it got faster and better, and then we got better radios for cell connections, and we had upgraded that, and so there were all these cumulative effects that seem to be stabilizing, and I feel like phones are commoditized now.
Yeah, no, I would completely agree with that. It felt 4 or 5 years ago, it kind of seemed like phones, we knew exactly what needed to be improved, and we knew that eventually they would, right? Now we're kind of at a point where all phones are very close to parity as far as what they offer. All the screens look great with small varying degrees. All batteries are pretty decent. You know, some of them are better than others. All cameras are pretty okay, unless you go too far down on the cost spectrum. So there aren't a whole lot of features that are must-have improvements that would convince everyone to automatically upgrade. Sure, we would love a better battery, but the batteries that we have are pretty sufficient, versus the specs that the other things that the phone does. So it's just different time.
If it has matured, and when you look at other products that have matured along these same sort of vectors, I'm thinking specifically of TVs when we got HD TVs, and then it got even, that resolution got better, and then it scanned faster. And then the next thing that happened is they tried to put some other crazy features in that nobody wanted,
right?
3D. Then the only play after that is making them cheaper. So I think it's a well-worn path, but not one that the two highest capitalized companies in the world want to go down is making their products cheaper.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Monty in the chat room says it's because the phones and us, we are 10 years older and our priorities have changed.
That is actually pretty true.
But then why would we be worried then? Because there are 20-year-olds out there wanting, they're the same.
So there would always be a group of people coming in that would kind of follow the patterns that we had 10 years ago.
Yeah,
but does that equal the amount of growth that we've had over the past 10 years when everybody's doing that versus just now a certain, group of people? I don't know.
Well, Segway creator Dean Kamen has teamed up with Toyota to bring back the iBot. That's a stair-climbing wheelchair that first debuted back in 2001. Back then, it was $25,000 per chair. The original iBot was financially unfeasible for most and was then discontinued in 2009. According to a Toyota press release, the company is working with Kamen again to create the motorized mobility solutions and starting with the iBot. So this is good news because I think the partnership with Toyota means that it maybe would come at a lower price point. It's really interesting. Leo and I on iOS Today were just lamenting the fact that accessibility features in software are so expensive, and same in hardware. I mean, I guess that's what you would call this motorized wheelchair. So it's exciting.
For those of you who haven't seen the iBot and don't remember it, it does this amazing thing where it kind of folds on top of itself and raises the person in the wheelchair so that their eyes are at eye level with other people. Now, that's not just sort of socially important. Think about counters in your kitchen. I mean, how would you like to be cutting the carrots all up at shoulder length as opposed to more like waist height? And then it also has this amazing ability to go up and down stairs. It can cruise over grass and kind of off-road a little bit. I am indignant about the failure of this device, because when I actually was reading about it today, it was incredible to me. So only about 100 of these sold per month when Johnson & Johnson was the distributor with Dean Kamen back in 2009, I think is when they took it off the market. So the price tag then was $22,000. But Medicare said that it was only worth $6,000. Which is incredible to me, because think of the tens of thousands of dollars that Medicare pays for a new hip in an octogenarian. My knee, I just got it scoped like a teeny little clean out, 25 grand. And that's more than this totally revolutionary device that's going to change people's lives. I just think that's, I don't know. I just think it's crazy. And it just shows you that policy and business ultimately can create success or failure for a piece of amazing technology.
Yeah. Electric car years ago. Yes, you're absolutely right, Becky. Segway, what does it cost? $6,000-$8,000, somewhere around there. Let's hope this is, you know, marginally right around that same area. I don't know how the cost of the Segway might translate into this, but I think there's probably some similar technology. You know, I mean, it's created by the same guy.
I feel like they said it was going to be in the high 20s again. Man, that it was going to be that they were going back at this at that high price. I don't know. I mean, maybe the Kaizen philosophy of Toyota, you know, where they take something and then they systematize it so that they can commoditize and get the prices down. Maybe they can do this in a way, to your point earlier, I think it was Megan, you said that would really make this feasible. But still yet, I just think that Medicare needs to really reassess this. And I wonder if sort of the Invictus, you know, we have so many vets coming home with issues around mobility and accessibility that I wonder if that might help from a public policy perspective. There is one interesting facet of this, which is it's not for every person who needs a wheelchair, because you need some mobility of at least one arm. So not that that's a reason for this not to succeed. I just really think that this is one where it just doesn't make sense to me when you think of so many other things that we spend money on.
Well, after the break, Google's creepy password killer. But first, let's take a minute to thank Epson, the sponsor of this episode. Epson's revolutionary EcoTank line of printers for home and office introduce a new age in printing. The new EcoTank ET4550 wireless all-in-one printer does not use ink cartridges. Instead, it features an innovative refillable ink tank, earning it the title of CES 2016 Innovation Awards honoree. The EcoTank ET4550 comes with enough black ink to print up to 11,000 black pages or 8,500 color pages. That's equivalent to about 50 ink cartridge sets. You're loaded and ready to print for up to 2 years. Powered by Epson's leading-edge precision core technology, it delivers high-speed, vivid colors and laser-quality black text, plus auto two-sided printing, a 30-page auto document feeder, and easy wireless printing from tablets and smartphones. All EcoTank printers deliver an unbeatable combination of convenience and value with ultra-low-cost replacement ink bottles. Epson recently released their Creative Print app. It makes it easy to preserve your Instagram and Facebook photos. Download the app to create personalized photo collages, custom greeting cards, stationery, and coloring book templates. You can also print photos directly onto CD or DVDs. Be creative on the go. Print from your mobile device to a variety of compatible Epson all-in-one printers with your wireless network. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank today to transform the way your home, office, or work group prints. For the best combination of ease and value, turn to the new Epson EcoTank printers. That's EPSON.com/EcoTank. And we thank Epson for their support.
All right, so we heard a lot last week on this show about the interesting projects that Google has its hands in. One of those, I will admit, seemed so pie in the sky when I heard about it a year ago that I was taken by surprise when Google announced the next stage of Project Abacus last Friday. Joining us to talk all about Project Abacus is Sean Hollister from CNET. How's it going, Sean?
Hey there. Doing pretty well. Yourself?
Excellent. Even better now that we have you on the line to talk a little bit about passwords. Google says that 70% of users forget their passwords once a month, which I know is true for myself. What is it about passwords that, I don't know, that makes them suck so badly?
I think I forget my password a lot more often than that. The problem for me personally is I use passwords that are a little bit similar to each other, and I can't remember the slight differences I make each time. Other times I go for really complex passwords, and then I completely forget what the heck they are. So Instead of that, Project Abacus wants to analyze how you use your computer and take that to mean that it's actually you. So instead of saying, hey, I'm going to type my password into this form, it'll say, well, how are you using your keyboard? When your fingers bounce off of the touch screen, if we analyze that data, if we combine that with what you look like, how your fingers bounce, little emails, you get all kinds of little signals it can have about you. It can say, this is actually you. It can get some kind of percentage score to make it feel like maybe it knows that this is you. And from there, if the organization using this score trusts that it is indeed you, it can say, yeah, that's probably him. Probably let him or her into that application.
Yeah, what's crazy, we're actually looking at a B-roll from last year's I.O., not this year's. They went into a lot more detail on it at last year's I.O., where basically what you're seeing now is a person who they trust, I guess what is now referred to as the trust API that's operating this behind the scenes, is using it. He's typing, you know, the phone can see his camera, see him on the camera. It uses all of these different data points to give a high trust score, and then somebody else comes on and their typing's different. They look different. You know, they've got different, maybe they bounce the phone in a different sort of way when they're typing. And all these things are tells to allow to make these indications.
Tells are really the right word. It's just these little subtle signals that it gets based on the sensors in the phone. You might not know that when you tap on the keys of your phone in a certain way, it's not just the order that you press them in. It's the way your phone moves. Maybe you shake it a little bit a certain way that other people don't. So they get a better idea of whether it's you or not.
So in your CNET article, Sean, you called it creepy. I've been criticized for using the word creepy. I mean, is it like weird? It's weird when you think about it. Like, oh, they know the way I walk. They know where I am, and they're using that. But is it really a violation? I mean, do you see it as a violation of privacy, all these trust scores?
It really depends on what your definition of privacy is and whether you care about privacy in the traditional sense. I personally don't. I'm of a generation where I believe it has something to do with the generation. Maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm just a person who doesn't care whether my privacy is invaded. Maybe you'll say that. But the idea for me is all of this information about me, most of the information that anyone would want to know about me is out there anyhow. I don't see myself finding a good way to protect against it, and I do have tangible benefits from the services that these companies provide for me. I'm willing to let Google know all these little things about me behind the scenes as long as I don't have to worry about typing a password in again, as long as I don't have to worry about getting home using driving directions. If it knows, hey, I'm on my way home, and it's going to recommend, you know, a gas station for me or something when I need that because it senses that my car needs gas, I'm okay if Google knows those kinds of things in order to help me out.
So Google basically what they announced essentially, and they spent very little time on it during the ATAP session on Friday, but they basically said that they're going to have a partner or partner banks that are testing this. Do we have any further information on that?
No. I reached out to Google today, but they didn't tell me which banks they're working with. They didn't say when exactly this is going to roll out and if it'll be a trial with actual users. But what we do know is there are several financial institutions that are going to be trialing this technology next month in June. And then if everything goes well, they say, they hope to roll it out to developers by the end of the year. Now, that's not us. That is developers who want to work on this technology, including banks. If a bank says, hey, I'm going to let somebody log into their account, see what their balance is, you know, to take a withdrawal out without typing in a password, that's going to be on the banks and the bank's software developers to decide that they trust this enough to use it.
Mm-hmm. Becky, how do you feel? How do you feel about handing over kind of your usage fingerprint, as it were, of how you use your device? I mean, it's taking all of these factors in, so it's kind of hard to even like understand like what kind of information you're giving them in a shake when you're using your phone. But how does it strike you?
I know that we need to have the contrasting voice for this is a violation of privacy and they don't need to have this information to be able to read if those are my eyebrows or my friend's eyebrows or if normally the place I'm in, you know, they have the right heuristics for making these decisions. Sadly, I cannot represent that point of view because anyone who can crack the password conundrum is a genius and will be a gazillionaire. So you can understand why there's a huge business model here for Google. And I was just, as I was listening to Sean, I was thinking about the enterprise applications for something like this because, you know, my password for ABC, it changes all the time. And then, you know, you're trying to make a memorable password, you try and remember it, and then you have to remake it 6 weeks, 8 weeks, whatever, 3 months later. Then you have to remember that one. And then you think of how much time corporate IT departments spend managing password, you know, the evaporation. I could see this as being so much bigger even than just what we're doing with our financial services apps and anything that mandates that level of privacy. You know, you also think about it. When we're seeing a lot of these big hacks, it's people using social engineering saying that they've forgotten their password. So if we can get rid of some of that social engineering aspects and give more aspects of protecting passwords and helping that whole system to just work better, I think it's really going to have a net effect of increasing privacy, not decreasing it.
And Google suggested that this may not just be for your core password, the password that you enter in to log into a service. This might replace your two-factor authentication. This might be the backup scheme that they use in addition to a password so that instead of right now I have to enter in a password and maybe I also have to log into a certain application on my phone to figure out what my timed code is that syncs with servers and all kinds of crazy server gibberish there. Instead of that, it might be something where you have to have remember your main password, your main PIN, or something like that. And then this is the more secure way of doing that second step to make sure that it actually is you.
Google has rolled out some interesting security measures in past. One of those was Face Unlock, which did not last very long. They actually brought it back in a different sense, and it's currently in Android devices, but you know, that was touted as a new, interesting, untried by others way of unlocking your device. How do you feel about what you're seeing with Project Abacus versus something, you know, that didn't succeed with Face Unlock?
Well, Face Lock really didn't succeed because it was a two-dimensional image. You could just take a picture of somebody and stick it up to your screen. If there was a picture of my face, you know, on a piece of paper, that could fool the system. But now we have depth cameras. We have cameras that can see in three dimensions. And that's something that we can actually use with Windows 10 now. Google isn't the only one working on this. Let's get rid of the whole password thing. Microsoft has something called Windows Hello, where if you've got a depth sensing camera built into your laptop, and there are a couple of those on the market now, if you've got a fingerprint reader or something like that, it can very, very quickly log you into Windows 10 without having a password. Microsoft is using this as part of something called the FIDO Alliance. They're a group of technology companies that want to take this very simple, you know, face login, fingerprint login, very, very easy login, and they want to translate that to the web as well. They want to say, you've logged into your operating system with this, and now that I know it's you, let's let you automatically log into websites with this kind of thing too. And that's a standard that's currently in development.
Right. And finally, real quick here, Megan and Ian Thompson last week discussed another of ATAP's big projects on Friday's show, ARA, Project ARA. But Sean, you posted a huge look into Project ARA yesterday. So I'm curious to know kind of your take on the project. Do people are people thirsting for this kind of modularity with their smartphone? What do you think?
Well, I talked to a lot of people in my circle, and I have to say, I've got a lot of PC gamers in my group, and they are a little bit disappointed that it's not as modular as it used to be. They wanted something even more modular, where they could basically build the phone from scratch by slotting in a processor, by slotting in memory modules. My wife, on the other hand, she says all she wants is additional batteries. She wants to just be able to drop an additional battery on top of the phone and extend its charge. And the Google engineer told me that you could get 45% additional battery life out of a single one of these little modular cells he had under the back of the phone. So if I could carry around four of those on a day that I know I'm going to be out and about, and if I can just leave them at home and just have one of those when I'm just going to have a day at work with the charger nearby all the time, that's something I'd pay for. It's something I think she might pay for.
I see the benefit of this in terms of upgrading as modules kind of age out, but I don't see it in terms of purchasing something that's customized to you, because a lot of things that you want, you can just buy sort of, there's so many different options in Android phones these days, you can get that. And then anything else you want, you can get as a case. To your wife's point, slapping a battery case on there, or the gal who does my makeup in New York, she has eyeshadow and lip gloss in her case. So really... I mean, unless they're offering that kind of modularity, then I just don't see it for me.
They just might, Becky. I'm not ruling it out. Not yet.
Sean's not going to address the lipstick. He's not going to address the makeup.
You didn't ask the lipstick question?
The thing I would say about cases is cases typically only fit the one phone that you get. And then the next time you get a phone 2 years down the road, they don't. They want these modules to be future-proof, though. They say that you buy a module today, you're going to be able to use it in the next Aura phone, the next Aura phone after that. So there's something to be said for future-proofing.
And the cases only have one other use case, right? Like I have a case that I use because it fits onto my armband for running, and it fits onto my, the thing that, the mount of my car. But like I would love to also have a battery case or eyeshadow.
Google had a really cool idea that didn't make it into my piece because they just threw it out there as kind of a wild suggestion. But they're thinking the same way you get these box services where you pay monthly for a box of stuff, your dog treats that come in the mail, the other swag that comes in the mail every month. They could have a quarterly Aura module club, a club where you'd sign up for this thing and you get the latest and greatest module. You can return it if you don't like it, or you could trade it in after a certain period of time. You just keep getting new things to try, new features for your phone.
Interesting. Like a Netflix for modular phones. It keeps getting deeper and deeper. This is a very strange future.
Birchbox, which is the makeup one. So I think we've got the perfect synthesis for
it. It all comes together, doesn't it? That's awesome. Sean Hollister, it's always awesome to get you on the show. So thank you so much for joining us. Tell people where they can find all your work online.
CNET.com. And thank you for having me, Jason.
Awesome. Starfire2258 on Twitter. Thanks again, Sean.
Well, YP Yasuda was writing in. He wrote us an email about a discussion that we had last week about Allo, Google's messaging app. Google won't make end-to-end encryption the default, P. Yasuda says, in any of its products because it will break Assistant. And if it were the default, I would turn it off because I want the help of Assistant and I want my communications to be searchable by me. So this is interesting because Ian Thompson and I had a long discussion about the fact that end-to-end encryption wasn't turned on by default in Google's new messaging app. And I got a lot of emails and tweets like this one saying, you know, they won't turn it on because then it breaks the features.
Yeah, exactly. I wondered this actually too, why, you know, and I guess there's a difference between end-to-end encryption versus encryption, you know, somewhere along the process. And if you want end-to-end encryption, then you can't really have that data transferring in and out. It's got to all be kind of locked down, kind of defeats the purpose from that to that point. Mm-hmm. And so then I guess, I don't know, use Hangouts or one of Google's other 10 messaging apps that provide different things.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're the type of person that wants all the features of Allo, like I want it to know, you know, so much about me that it really assists in my day-to-day communications. Yeah. You're not the same kind of, you know, if you're not that kind of person, if you need end-to-end encryption for whatever, you know, if you're a whistleblower, if you are just concerned about your privacy to an extent, that you're probably not going to use Allo anyway. You're probably going to use, you know, WhatsApp or Signal or Telegram, one of those instead.
Yeah, but I want it all. That's me, though. And I called it Ello on Twitter earlier, not even realizing it. I know it's called Allo, but I called it Ello, and I just want to remove Ello from occupying space in my brain because I will never use it again.
Well, I don't, it's like it's Allo, but then Leo also pronounced it like Allo.
Allo.
Like, not like Allo, but like it was just in between Allo and Allo.
He's French. Don't listen to him.
It's true.
I have a really bad sunburn, and I'd like some Allo.
Yeah, that's
hey,
what I
there we
too.
Go. Do you want your Allo encrypted, or will that improve your sunburn?
I want it more like from a bottle and not too stinky.
All right, not too overly floral.
I don't want it too organic.
Yeah, not too floral. Coming up, Becky takes a look at the Internet of Things, and kind of we'll take a look together at what's working at this point. But first, let's take a minute to thank ZipRecruiter, the sponsor of this episode. If you're hiring, you know, you need to know where to find all those job applicants. Do you know where to post your job to find them? If you want to find the perfect hire, you're going to need to post on all of the top job sites. That's not easy. Now you can do it with ZipRecruiter. You post your jobs in one place, and you're not going to get very many quality candidates. That's just the reality. You don't want to leave it up to chance. You want to reach those people. So ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to more than 100 job boards, including social media networks, places like Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, all with a single click. You just post one time, and you'll watch. All those candidates are just going to roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. ZipRecruiter offers optimized pages that look great on any screen, which makes it even easier to see all of those candidates. You can add their unique mobile apply process to your experience for even more visitors and more applicants. You can find candidates in any city or industry nationwide, and you won't have to juggle emails or manage calls to your office. You can actually add multiple users to your account so you can get some help with the process. You can quickly screen candidates with real-world questions. They have a free form, multiple choice, or yes-no formats in that process that you can choose from. View candidate responses in conjunction with their beautifully formatted resumes. You can rate them, hire the right person, and it's all about hiring that person fast. You want to find them as quickly as possible. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. More than 100 million candidate applications have been delivered, and it's time for them to get delivered to you. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT to check it out for yourself, and we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. TNT's fan of the day is Shailpik from Kolkata, the capital of West Bengal in India, and by the way, the second largest city inside India behind Mumbai. As far as I can tell, Shailpik runs a production studio and is a DJ and electronic musician. I kind of looked at a few other Instagram images. This came in through Instagram. This picture appears to be Shailpik listening to TNT while taking a break from production in the evening, and I love it because global reach. I love how the internet gives a show like Tech News Today this kind of global reach. Thanks for sending that in. You can also show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup, your surroundings. Post it on Instagram, Google+, or Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we'll find it.
I am not proud to admit this. My home is pretty dumb. I still have to turn my lights on and off by myself with my hand.
The horror.
Becky, you've been looking into the promise of the smart home. What have you learned?
Not many of us have the smart home. Your home is probably above average and you don't even know it. I've been doing some, for those of you who are listening and not watching, I am coming to you live from my kitchen, a place where there are many appliances, the hub of my home. And I've been doing some upgrades around the house. We put in a new front door. So I got a Bluetooth and Wi-Fi enabled lock. It's starting to be the time of year in California where my 10x10 patch of grass that I have kept needs to be sprinkled sparingly, but I cannot face another year of dealing with my sprinkler programmer system. So I am happily upgrading to a smart sprinkler system. That's my job tomorrow to install the Rockio.
That's a Twit sponsor. They're a Twit sponsor. That's okay to talk about them. It's Rockio.
Well, then I better make sure I said it right. How do you say it?
Rockio.
So I'm going to get my Rockio out. Ralph Macchio is going to come help me. But
I wondered if you were going to go there.
I couldn't figure out why I was saying it. Like, I'm from Philly. I'm like, Rockio.
He got the Rockio.
So, but I was just really curious, as others are sort of making upgrades in their home, what are they doing? So I did a little bit of research, and Business Intelligence put out a report earlier this year saying we're at this, they use the word chasm, between early adopters and the mass market jumping into the smart home fray. So another survey from a company called Statista, they said in 2016, smart home products, $9.7 billion market. Expected to grow to $20 billion in 4 years. So more than double. Now, that's not including things like refrigerators that have internet access, you know, so that you can, it's not that kind of like just things with tablets built into them. This doesn't include tablets. It's more like appliances that are controlled by Wi-Fi or Bluetooth or app. Household penetration is at 5.8%. So, Megan, this is the big question. If it's 5.8% for household penetration of smart appliances or smart devices, it's expected to go up near 20% by 2020. I think you're actually ahead of the curve. And I did a little inventory, and I want to hear what you guys have. Off the top of your head, what do you have in your house that's a smart device?
Well, I have the Amazon Echo. And I
That's
have
pretty
the,
smart.
Yeah,
inclusion.
The Dot. They're yeah. both those are both very smart. I have the Ring Video Doorbell, which is also a Twit sponsor. Mm-hmm. And I think that's it. I have many hubs. I like how you called your kitchen your hub of your home. The hub is like the bane of my existence in terms of the smart home, because I have all these hubs and they don't work with everything. Like that's what I want. So it's really like the lights. That's what I would. When I think of a smart home, I think of like a way to turn off and on your lights, or you're like, I don't have a Nest, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. So yeah, it really depends on the hub. And I also feel like I'm so ingrained in the Apple ecosystem that I feel like the HomeKit should work for everything, and it really doesn't, or I just haven't taken the time to make it work.
Right. I'm so glad you brought this up. And before I audit Jason's home and what he has in his underwear drawer, I'm so glad you brought this up about the HomeKit, because I think it was 3 years ago, the product of CES that CNET chose was two or three, Revolve Home Hub that was going to unify all of these smart devices. I haven't seen that thing anywhere in years. I don't even know if they're still in business.
They're not.
They're
dead. Like the...
That died, and then supposedly Apple, or in this case, now that Google is trying to enter the home market more, although it's more with an Alexa competitor, but, you know, I think that there's this sense of it, and Apple's had this HomeKit out for a year or so. I fired up my phone today and was looking for, okay, I just was like trying to find out what I have that's HomeKit compatible, and I looked up HomeKit. I can't even find it on my phone. I can't even find in the devices apps where I'm supposed to integrate it. This is not working. And I mean, I'll give you the quick inventory. I have the Philips lights, the Hue lights. I have the Sonos, the Nest. I have a Wi-Fi connected solar meter, Apple TV, DirecTV with a Genie thing. Someone sent me a sous vide cooker with a Wi-Fi connection.
I have that. Let me put that on my list. I forgot about
He's
that
making
one.
An actual list.
See? I got the lock on my door. I got a thermometer for my kids when they get sick. Then that connects. I don't know if that really, but I consider that kind of an appliance. And then the sprinkler system. And I have no idea how I'm supposed to integrate these into the Apple HomeKit. So I agree with you completely. Jason, what's on your list?
All right, let's see here. Ring Video Doorbell, which we've already made sure people know. They're a sponsor on the Twit Network. Logitech Smart Hub, which is actually a remote control hub, but it also can control your smart home.
I hadn't even thought about that. I have one of those, and yeah. I never even thought about using that for some of this
stuff.
There
you go. It totally taps into it. We have a thermostat that's connected via Wi-Fi. It was just part of like renovations included in, which makes me think like, you know, a part of kind of the future of smart homes is the fact that just things are going to start more and more coming with Wi-Fi built into it, whether you intend to buy them that way or not. They just kind of have it as an extra feature, such as the case with that thermostat. Chromecast Audio times 2, and I only put that in there because it's mainly driving stereos and can be kind of connected in that way as well. So, I mean, I don't know if that qualifies, but I'll put it in there. And then the Anova sous vide. Strangely, the Anova sous vide, yes, it's totally qualifies on this list as well.
Well,
which, by the way,
example.
Makes excellent sous vide steak.
It makes a great sous vide. But yeah. My question, why is it Wi-Fi connected? Am I leaving my steak on the counter in a bowl of water for 10 hours while I'm at work and then firing this thing up? That seems scary to me. I'm clearly not using it right. But you're totally right. And when I was doing the research, this is something that really came up, was the barrier to entry for folks on this is, it's Megan's point, confusing ecosystem or closed ecosystems or just fractured ecosystems. And then the second one was your point, which is all these things, they have long replacement cycles, and we're just going to get them now with Wi-Fi as we upgrade. So this is going to take a lot of time.
Yeah.
I forgot to mention my Apple TV. I also have that.
Yeah. Do you guys have the new one or the old one?
I have the new one. But, you know,
what's
just
better?
It has Siri on the remote, so I can, you know, ask her to find good movies for tweens, or, you know, the last move, like who starred in Beaches, that kind of thing that you might need to know.
We need to know this. It's
the film, the great film, show. Who is the Wind Beneath My Wings, those sorts of things. Yeah.
Bette Midler, Barbara Hershey, by the way.
Thanks, Siri. It is fascinating. I mean, we, you know, with a Google Home, was showed off at Google I/O, and I know Jason was like, "I'm ready. He's all in.
I'm
gonna get one."
Yeah.
And I was thinking, like, what? Why can't Siri just be this? Like, why do I need another device when I have Siri? And I did a bunch of testing this weekend to see if Siri could work. Like, if I just set up an iPad with speakers, could I do the same thing? And it's not the same.
Yeah, because it turns out you need a really good kind of control hub, which goes back to what both of you are saying, is that it's almost like that's the last mile of smart home, is getting a hub that can actually do something with all these things. We have all these things. That's great. That's air quotes smart. But a true smart home gives you the ability to control them all from like a centralized place or a centralized method easily. And that's the hard part. I think that's the big challenge here. Amazon Echo's doing it to a certain degree. Google's, of course, attempting to do it with Google Home. I don't know who's going to win. It feels very early on. Because, like you say, there's a lot of different standards. They got to all get on the same page. I don't know if that's going to happen.
I know. It seems like Alexa has the whole I/O thing down, and really people seem to interact so freely with Alexa and Dot. But then you've got an ecosystem problem. So I think it's still the Wild West out there.
And what do we do when it's retro to, you know, go back to wires? You know, it's like, cool, because that's what they used to do.
Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, that's the big question, right? Do we want our lights to go on and off automatically?
Right.
You know,
it sounds like the future, but it could end up being one of those things where, like, man, I never use that. I can now, and I never use it. Or, wow, that's actually really incredibly inconvenient, because when I expected it to go off was when I'm not using it. It turns out I was just using it, and it went off on me.
Yeah. I mean, I understand for energy consumption, it would be great. Like, oh, I want to make sure all my lights are off.
Sure.
Of course. But, it's got a long way, I think.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. Mm-hmm. Tell us how you all feel about that. TNT@twit.tv. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. Give us your audit of your smart
home. That'd be cool.
Becky Worley, always a pleasure.
It's so fun to be with you guys. I really enjoy it. And it's so great for me because it keeps me current on all the tech stuff when I've got my head in all the consumer stuff for GMA. So thank you for that.
Absolutely. So GMA, this is kind of your thing. When should people tune in? When do they tune in to find you?
What am I going
to
be doing? What am I doing? Yeah. I'm on next Tuesday, but I'll be with you next Tuesday too. So next Tuesday is all at B Worley from Twitter all the time.
All right, thanks, Becky.
Bye, guys.
Take care.
Have a good night. We'll talk to you soon.
You too. Take care.
TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can take part in the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. You can also leave us a short voicemail. We'll probably play it. 260-TNT-SHOW. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Tech News Today TV.
Send us a video, too. Like,
yeah,
you record
like
a video on your smartphone and email it to us. We would love to play that and see your pretty face. You can subscribe to the show at twit.tv/TNT. I am at Megan Maroney on Twitter.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to our technical director, Brian Burnett. Actually, thanks to the Burnett brothers for helping us produce this show every single day. Thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see you all tomorrow. Bye. We'll